Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Thursday, April 30th. I'm your host, Richard Benulli, and we have returning guest Charles Hugh Smith. Charles is author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including Investing in Revolution, The Mythology of Progress, Ultra-Processed Life, and Investing in Revolution are a trilogy. And today we'd like to discuss when Charles will become bullish. There are several areas we wanted to discuss under that. What are the problems and the challenges? And then we always look to end with a positive ideas, some suggestions, and just overall ideas that can help provide solutions. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, when I wrote a piece a few weeks ago called What Would Make Me Bullish? And the reason why I wanted to discuss this today was, you know, in the sort of financial media or the mainstream media, then what's we're told that's bullish is GDP goes up, corporate profits are going up, the banking sector's sound, the US dollar's, you know, holding its value, and big tech is innovating. And so all those things are what we hear about and why we're supposed to be bullish, right? Stock market's going up, GDP's going up, all that. But what that misses, in my view, is that's what the top 10% looks at, the managerial class, right? Because they own the assets that are soaring in, you know, stocks and real estate. They're the managers. They're the ones that have the assets that are soaring in value. The bottom, say, 80%, of the population is living on wages. And if you only have wages and very modest amounts of assets, then what you're experiencing is a completely different America. And in that America, you're losing purchasing power. Your wages are buying less and less for a couple of reasons. One is planned obsolescence. You could also call it the subscription model. You know, instead of something like you used to be able to buy a refrigerator that would last 40 years, now your refrigerator dies in 4 years, right? And it's unrepairable. You can't repair it. And then when the repair guy comes, it's so expensive, you might as well buy another one. And then, or your Apple phone no longer works because it doesn't have enough memory to run the bloated software. And so that's eating away at purchasing power. And we've lost the incentives financially and socially to make durable products and services that are affordable and high quality, right? So we get low quality and then we have to throw it away or dispose of it. So there's that. Then the second thing is healthcare. For the average American, they don't really care about GDP or corporate profits. What they're looking at is trying to keep their health insurance. And so it traps people. They can't move and they can't change jobs because they have health insurance, right? And it's up to $30,000 now per household for a family, right? So the employer is paying $30,000 per person, a full-time employee, for the family coverage. And so that healthcare is a significant burden to the household and the employer. And what I find odd is it's now so expensive. It's approaching 20% of the entire GDP of the United States. That it's a burden that could bankrupt the nation, because like Medicare and Medicaid alone are over $2 trillion a year. And they're in this like parabolic, you know, rise in cost because of aging and so on. So that's it's funny that when we talk about, oh, big tech and corporate profits, and it's mostly like looking at healthcare as a source of profits, not as a source of a cost that the country and employers and households can't bear. So, and then the third thing is like that difference, the asymmetry that you and I have discussed before about who gets the gains in the economy and who gets the pain. And so the pain is going to wage earners and the gains are going to asset holders, right? And so it's getting to the point of where that's going to create like political turmoil, you know, especially if we eventually get a recession or we're already in a recession. So there has to be some way to rebalance some of these extremes in terms of who gets the gains in the economy and who gets the pain. So that's what would make me bullish is we recognize that the loss of durability is like a long-term negative for the economy and everybody in that economy, that healthcare has got to be fixed, not just kind of tweaking the edges here, but it needs to be rebuilt from the bottom up so it actually functions and is affordable. And then we have to do something with the imbalance between assets and wages. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. So maybe you can take it from there and give me some feedback on those topics.
No, those are big ones. I mean, even the one on assets and wages, I think in your article, you talk about money printing, right? It can't be used to solve everything. And in fact, we've talked about this, right? You've pointed out in the past, quantitative easing by central banking organizations, central banks, governments, just printing money out of thin air. Obviously creates tons of debt, but interestingly also it benefits more of the financial sector above Main Street. And so it causes extreme wealth and income inequality. It exacerbates to a significant extent that difference in the widening gap of, you know, wealth and income inequality. Because what happens, I'll just give you a quick example. You know, a bank can go to the window, you know, in the old days when for many years the interest rates were very low, they could go and borrow at 0.25%. And then immediately on the same day, they buy a bond for 4% and make the difference, right? 3.75%, essentially free. And then they can lever that up, right, as part of the financial sector, whereas it's not part of Main Street. It's not that's just a simple example how central banking is making all of that worse. And just your thoughts on that. Did you want to elaborate, yeah, more from your articles?
Yeah, Richard, I think that's an excellent point, because what happens is that the private equity and large corporations and banks, they have the ability to borrow basically almost limitless amounts of money. And then they can go into the real estate market and snap up single family homes as investments. And they can always outbid a household depending on wages, right? Because, you know, it's like, there's an asymmetric difference there that the wealthiest entities can always outbid households. So the households now, if you're younger and you're not in your peak earning years and your parents aren't wealthy enough to help you, then you're basically priced out of a lot of housing markets. So that's another example of this, the damage that's done to the economy with this kind of favoring assets and financiers. So I think we can look at healthcare. I just want to say, I'm going to repeat one anecdote is kind of, which I think sort of summarizes what's wrong with healthcare in America. I saw a social media post by a physician, and she said that she refused to get her own health insurance because she thought it was a ripoff. So she pays cash for her care. And so she had a reason to go to the emergency room for an hour. And then she was billed $13,000. And that is not by any means unusual in America. So she went in and said, hey, I'm not insured. So they dropped it $5,000 instantly to $8,000. And she said, what does that say about our system that they just dropped $5,000? That was the price, and they just drop it like it's nothing. And so then she tried to haggle about some test that she'd been given that she'd been charged $900 for or whatever, and they dropped it $20. And so she says, why do we tolerate this system? And I think that's a very good question. And so when we talk about solutions, we have to look at how is it that people aren't in full-blown rebellion against a system that's so unfair, so rapacious, so exploitive, you know, and it's so unaffordable. And I think we can kind of talk about the solutions, starting with there has to be some real competition, and there has to be the ability of small entrepreneurs to get into this space and offer real competition. So, for example, I think there's basically like three huge insurers in the U.S., and then there's like several hospital chains and a handful of big pharmaceuticals. And those companies basically control healthcare, right, because they can buy the political influence. So trying to find, like, say, a doctor that you could just pay cash like in the good old days, there's very few people who are set up to do that. And it's very expensive because they have to buy insurance. So it goes back to one of the things that you've talked about, Richard, which is, you know, the United States has become like a nation of attorneys and sort of extraction from insurance and the law, as opposed to being productive. And so I think there is a solution to healthcare, but it's going to require breaking up all these monopolies and cartels and allowing real competition at the most basic level.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Yeah, and if you think about it, like, there's so many influences now. So you have doctors that are essentially have a conflict of interest with delivering the Hippocratic oath, right, to their patients, because they're influenced by the pharmaceutical sector, right? So the pharmaceutical sector says, you know, if you administer this type of medication or vaccine, then, you know, you'll get so much extra bonus money, or so it incentivizes, right, the doctors to give more. So many people, like, on 4, 5, 6 medications, this is fairly standard. And some of those have to address side effects and negative side effects of the main treatment. So, and then it eventually causes deterioration of health, right, on a long-term basis. So that's very negative. The insurance I see as also being similar to the negatives of representative democracy that we've talked about, representative democracy versus direct democracy. So what we have generally is representative democracy, where that also exacerbates that first issue we just talked about, where, you know, politicians saying, elect me, I'll give you all these things for free, and we'll pillage the treasury, we'll print money, we'll issue bonds, we'll borrow money, right? So that it can only go on for so long, right? The money printing is not a solution. But that is an effect coming from representative democracy. And similarly, the insurance sector is like that, right? Because you're basically the insurance sector saying, just pay a little bit of money and we'll give you all these treatments for free, right? So everybody buys into that. But in the end, either insurance claims are tend to be denied, or you know, don't cover everything, or are basically gouging in a way that benefits the doctor or whoever is billing the insurance company.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a very insightful point, Richard. That the dynamic of that relationship is the same: is that overpromise and then underperform, and then at a cost that's unaffordable. And so, I also want to speak again to this thing of the difference between owning assets and being a wage earner. And of course, people have both. They have jobs, and then they're making money on their stocks and real estate. But think about it from the point of view of the employer. Like, they're seeing their cost skyrocket. And, you know, I've been an employer in the past, and I go back and I go, okay, how much did I pay for each of my employees? Standard healthcare in the mid-1980s or late 80s. And it was like, you know, in today's money, it was like $300 or something like that for an individual. And then now it's double or triple that. And for a family, I think we paid $600 or whatever. And now it's like thousands a month. And so something's broken in that kind of system when you have expenses, or the cost of it is skyrocketing far above any kind of rational explanation or inflation. So what does the employer have to do? Well, then they basically are squeezing the wage earners. Like, you know, they hire people that work and only pay them for a certain number of hours, so they don't have to give them health insurance. They hire them as 1099, you know, workers who are on contract, or they try to, or nowadays it's like we, you know, try to replace you with an AI agent because they can't afford healthcare. And so the healthcare on the employees. And so it's strange to me that there's this sort of blind spot in the political system. And the reason we know why it's a blind spot is they're collecting tens of millions, or probably in aggregate hundreds of millions of dollars of donations and campaign contributions, you know, like regulatory capture, as you say. So how do we break out of this? And it's going to take some action at the federal level to break up these monopolies and cartels and allow some competition. Because I want to go back to that point that when you talk to experts and people in this industry, they often point out that the relationship between the customer, in this case the patient, and the cost and what they're getting for that cost has been broken in healthcare in America, because their employer's paying an insurance company, and their copay, if they have gold-plated insurance, is modest, $25, $35, whatever. So they have no interest in like how much the actual cost is. So the customer doesn't care about the price. Well, then of course the price is going to go to the moon. So that was the benefit of a cash-based system, is then you could say, well, how much is this going to cost? And then you'd go, what am I getting for it? And then you could do the calculation there of whether it was worth it. And then you'd be seeking alternatives if it was unaffordable. And so I think, to kind of summarize, as you pointed out, when you have a central bank and a government that just prints trillions in order to make sure that everybody's happy, like there's no budget, there's no constraints, and then you get a system where you end up with price gouging because the money is free. And so there's that. And then there's also the cartels and the monopolies that get regulatory capture, and there's no real competition. And so in a way, I call it privatized, you know, communism. Because if you only have two or three insurers and two or three hospital chains, and you really don't have an option, then what's the difference between that and the communist regime? Because in fact, there's more competition in a quasi-communist country like China, where you can still just go in and pay cash for healthcare. And so I think we need to have that kind of opening where there's competition in every level of healthcare. And as you and I were speaking about before we started recording, this lack of competition and price insensitivity in the U.S. system is why people go and for medical tourism. In other words, they go to Mexico or Southeast Asia or elsewhere where the price is like a fraction of the cost in the U.S. And the tests and the equipment are the same.
Mm-hmm. It can be done on the same day. You walk in, get some diagnosis, maybe have an MRI for $100 or $200 the same day, and maybe more advanced, more recent systems than in the G7 world. And much, as you mentioned, a fraction of the cost and likely to be higher quality because it also, they usually combine, right? And Asia, more of the Asian Ayurvedic medicine. There could be acupuncture, more emphasis on the quality of food, right? The, you know, you're eating glyphosate laden wheat or, you know, all of that, right? So I think all of that comes into play.
Absolutely. To your point, the healthcare system in the United States is not actually delivering a healthier population. I would say by any standard, people like to try to game the statistics, say, oh, well, it's better because people are living longer. But if you look at lifespans, they've moved very little, actually. They have not advanced. And the overall health in daily experience of Americans has plummeted. And of course, as you say, it's related to the food, the ultra processed food and lack of fitness and overall stress level. And again, I go back to this thing of if you want to have a healthy economy and a healthy society and you want me to be bullish about it, then you've got to start looking at how to improve the quality of life of the bottom 80%, not just keep heaping more trillions of dollars of gains and assets on the top 10%, which is what the U.S. is doing now. All right. It's like it's supporting the economy by these asset bubbles, which enrich the top 10%, who then can spend freely because they have this enormous capital gains, which, by the way, are taxed at 20%, where, wage earners, I mean, we pay 15.3% in social welfare, right? The employer and the employee, and then the basic tax rate is 15%. So it's like, well, wage earners are paying 30%, even if for the lowest possible income, you know, on every dollar. And then people raking off millions in capital gains pay less tax. So you have to kind of wonder, what if that was flipped around and wage earners, employees paid less and employers paid less tax, and the capital gains increased a bit, you know? So there's those kinds of possibilities if we look at rebalancing the economy so that the wage earners are not always losing ground, you know, that they're at least getting some benefits in terms of improved quality of life. And I think there is definitely solutions. It just has to be recognized that regulatory capture can't just be the sole mechanism that controls the political and financial system of the United States.
Mm-hmm. And I would venture to go, it's even affected like this vision of a reshoring. We just put out a Substack posting today on that, the reshoring illusion. As you mentioned, the U.S. can throw tons of money financing at potential projects and rare earths and all this. And it's not likely to happen, right? Because you've got all of these, the regulatory capture, too many regulations in place. You need so many permits at different levels, municipalities. The lawyers get involved to make sure those, you know, that gives you an extra leg of difficulty in trying to build something. And at the end of the day, it results in a nation where there's not, doesn't have the skill sets on top of that to build what's needed. You know, we used to be a nation of making things, building things, designing things, but if you look at most of the job openings today, it's more like, you know, regulatory compliance officer, accountant, government employee. You know, there's nobody making anything, right? It's, you know, you really, I think if you go into engineering, you might have difficulty finding work, but, you know, if you have a PhD in engineering, you'd be like head of high speed trains in China, right? If you go to China. So yeah, in some sense, the US has become a nation of lawyers versus China, a nation of engineers.
Right. And so I think if we're going to summarize like solutions, I think we have to kind of follow the investment idea that you look at incentives, right? And mm-hmm. and what I've described in my view today in our discussion is all the incentives are for regulatory capture, for gouging, price gouging, taking advantage of these regulatory loopholes and the power of cartels and monopolies. All of these incentives are negative for the nation and the society, households and employers. So we need to recognize that and change the incentives around to where transparency of pricing, connecting the customer to the cost, opening up these sectors to real competition. All of these would be incentivizing positive changes that would improve the quality of life at a lower cost for virtually every participant, you know, employee, employer, investor, everyone would benefit. So it requires what I call a cultural revolution, if you will, because we need to change what we value. And we got to start there. So, and then you change the incentives, mm-hmm. then you change the system.
Yeah, that's your latest book, right? Investing in Revolution from
that's
that
right.
perspective.
That's right.
Yeah, and just to summarize as well on, so that you have representative democracy versus direct democracy. You know, if we had direct democracy, do you want to have this, right? There's more of power in the people that can answer questions to allow or not allow, you know, insurance or pharmaceutical control, right, at that level.
Reconnect the customer and voter. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Anything else from that book that could be highlighted as well from a solution perspective?
One of my themes in Investing in Revolution is I don't want to set up a sort of an either or us versus them. Like, it's not wage earners versus financiers. What I kind of see is if we change the incentives, there's room for everybody to benefit. I mean, in other words, as investors, it's like, it's sort of perverse if you're going to be making more money investing in cartels that are ripping people off, you know, and it, you know, it you could, you'd feel better about your investment and you probably would get a better return if you were investing in something that was truly productive, you know, that, in other words, it was lowering costs and improving the quality of life. So I just would say that there's room for everybody to benefit from changing the incentives and what we value, what we prioritize. So, and healthcare would be a very big place to start because the potential benefits of you know, reforming that and creating a system that actually works and is affordable would be so profound. It would be tremendous, right? For the government, for the nation, for society and households, employers, everybody would benefit. So I think that's something to look at, you know, like there is a positive option there that would benefit everybody. We just have to change the incentives and what we value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's our positive conclusion is on those words of wisdom. Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Richard. Appreciate the chance to talk about these other topics that often don't get enough coverage.
Yep. Thanks.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only. and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.